Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener. Yes, it is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. And on this occasion, Scott is back with us. Scott, good to have you back.
Thank you very much for having me back. It's, you know, it's one of those things I'm going to go to once a month. But anyway, yes. I'm glad to be back.
We're fortunate to have the 12th man to step up to the crease. Well, actually, a 12th man doesn't actually step up to the crease because he doesn't get to bat. But trot out onto the field and just chase the ball around. That's kind of what a 12th man does. And
exactly.
Paul does a great job. So thank you,
Paul. He does.
So, Scott, this week, even just the regular news has been, I think, dominated by the ACL, Lyle Shelton, Q&A, like Safe Schools program. It's just really hit the sort of general news, hasn't it, I think?
It has really exploded this week. And, you know, it's crazy, but it is what it is. So,
I think regular listeners to this podcast, Scott, would be quite chuffed with themselves because they would have been completely up to speed about the Safe Schools program, the history of it, you know, the ACL sniffing around trying to get rid of it. I mean, we started covering Safe Schools many, many months ago.
And, we did indeed.
So there you go. We had our finger on the pulse there, dear listener, and had you fully prepared for the week's events. So, of course, the Christian right has agitated and the government has announced that they're going to review the Safe Schools program. And I guess a big talking point for us, Scott, was that Lyle Shelton, head of the ACL, was on Q&A. And you saw the performance. What did you think?
Well, I saw the performance and, I think Karen Phelps had his measure. I think, you know, when it come down to that blow, then I think she handled herself very well indeed. The question from the audience that got all the news coverage when the bloke who was the 65-year-old Christian put up his hand and said, when are we going to have, what does the ACL, why does the ACL think they represent all Christians?
Yeah.
You know, fair enough. But, it was, I take your point, because I think you said week before, a couple of weeks ago anyway, you said that all you need to do is say something that's slightly progressive and you get a whole heap of round of applause from the audience. And you know what? You are dead right. he said something that was progressive and, shut them down.
So, you know, what I would have liked, and we discussed, I think it was last week, the National Secular Society chairman in the UK was talking about how the religious right is debating these sorts of issues. And rather than saying, you know, the Bible tells me this and I think this is what God wants, they bring out, you know, other ideas that they try and latch onto as a justification for their position. And I just would really have loved it if somebody on Q&A had, you know, midway or towards the end said, Lyle, you've never once mentioned God or the Bible in this, but the truth is that your key reason for objecting to this program is you think God doesn't like it. And, you're mounting these arguments about so-called protecting the children, etc., which don't make sense to anybody. And the reason they don't make sense is because you're just latching onto those as some other excuse when your real reason is God and the Bible. And why don't you just say that? And that's your real reason. Like, somebody needed to force him to start using God and the Bible in his reasons because he couldn't deny it. And put it a bit more in that context. So,
you see, that's a bloody good point, yes.
So yeah. That's what I would have liked to have seen, the sort of attack on Lyle Shelton, because I gather that's his typical modus operandi, is to be very courteous and low-key and talk in generalities and be very hard to sort of pin down. And he's, you know, obviously very clever at that, and sort of faking genuine concern about rights of children, for example, when he really doesn't have that concern at all, and it's just a smokescreen for his other reasons. So I just think if somebody ever gets hold of him and nails him in that way, that would be what I'd like to see. So,
yeah, it really would be. It really would be a very useful something that we can hang our hat on, is if he actually gets up there and says what he actually really thinks.
Actually, yeah. On this topic, Scott, so I came across, I don't think I mentioned this to you, an article, because I was thinking, you know, I'm hearing about Daniel Andrews in Victoria and his response to safe schools, and I thought, I haven't heard anything about Queensland, and I think I might have Googled just to try and find what the local players in Queensland said, and Tim Mander came out, I saw an article in the Daily Telegraph.
Right.
And he said that the Safe Schools program has been hijacked by activists, and he also talked about it containing adult content that wasn't suitable for children. You probably didn't see that?
Oh, I didn't see that, no.
Yeah.
No.
So, look, I think that came out... let me get my date straight here, but if it came out on the 27th, I fired off a press release to the reporter at the Daily Telegraph the next day. And I'll just read a bit of it, hoping she would publish this. So sort of in response to what Tim Mander had said, and I said, "It is amazing he can say that with a straight face, actually," said Mr. Bell. Tim Mander is a former CEO of Scripture Union Queensland, an organisation involved in placing volunteer Bible bashers in our state schools. For the most part, these volunteers are not providing balanced religious education, but instead seek to indoctrinate children into an evangelical form of the Christian faith. If he's worried about activists in our schools, he should start with a look at the religious instruction lessons Scripture Union promotes. And a bit further on, I say something like, because we talked last week, Scott, about the materials that Scripture Union is using in the schools, and children as young as five are taught that God punished the Jews for not driving out other nations completely. So I kind of refer to that and suggest that, you know, well, that's an adult concept that I don't think five-year-olds should be dealing with. So if Tim Mander is worried about adult concepts, so... Anyway, fire that off to Amy Remicus, the reporter, and she didn't publish it. But she said the story had moved on, and I was basically the very next day. But anyway, I had a few emails back and forward with her subsequently, and hopefully next time this issue comes up, because it is under review, then she might actually contact me for a comment so that we can actually... get some press on that one. So,
well, that would be very useful. Yeah.
So I tried as hard as I could, folks. Like, saw the article, fired off a press release on point to the reporter who'd done a very similar story, and no success. So it's not easy. It's not easy. But anyway, I think I said in there as well. Oh yeah, this argument that we're just talking about. I said. Well, there was a paragraph in the press release that reads like this. The Secular Party questioned the real reason for Tim Mander's objection. "The hypocrisy makes me question whether there are other motives," said Mr. Bell. "I suspect that Mr. Mander is convinced God approves of religious instruction lessons, but disapproves of anything that might support homosexuality. Unable to trot out God's will as his reason, he's forced to construct a nonsensical argument using notions of activism and age appropriateness." So there you go. I've used part of my own debating style in that, and Without success, but we'll keep going, Scott. And
no, well, we'll it was a very good press release.
Mm. Yeah. So there we go. That was Safe Schools and the ACL. And, oh, there's an article that we came across, Scott, written by Stephanie Judd.
Yes.
And I really don't like most of the article, but I did find of interest the statistics that she had there. Do you want to mention what they were?
The statistics were very good. I don't know, I haven't done the numbers on it, but there were, shall we say, 75 press releases that the ACL's put out in since 2014. 53 of those were on same-sex marriage. Mm. 11 were on refugees, 6 were on safe schools, 5 were on sexualisation, blah, 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 blah. Yep. You know, it's amazing that they... I don't know why they got to get their knickers in a twist over same-sex marriage. It really is phenomenal that out of all the problems there are in Australia,
yep,
that more than half of them would be... that more than half of your press releases would be related to same-sex marriage.
Yeah, it would have to be about two-thirds of their press releases were on same-sex marriage, yeah.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Mm. Anyway.
But this writer, Stephanie Judd, at the end of the article, she's described as a commercial lawyer in Sydney and attends St. Barnabas Anglican Church, which kind of makes sense because when you read the article, she actually quotes parts of the Bible in a pretty worrying way.
Well, she does.
Yeah. But and she tries to sort of mount an argument that the Australian Christian lobby is not as influential as the Twitter sphere would suggest. And she says, yes, they're noisy, and yes, the media often gives them a platform out of a sense of fascinated outrage. But the occasions on which they've changed political outcomes are few indeed. And I would disagree, because I'm convinced that they're behind the chaplaincy program we've got here. I'm convinced that they're behind the plebiscite rather than the parliament just passing the legislation. I'm convinced that they have had this Safe Schools program reviewed.
Yeah, but I mean, I think we could, you know, that Safe Schools program, you know, she's got a paragraph here. I hazard a guess that if the ACL did alert Senator Corey Bernardi or MP George Christensen to Safe Schools material, Senator Bernardi and Mr. Christensen spoke out against the program, not because they were persuaded by the ACL or receptive to their power, but because they had pre-existing sympathies and views about public morality that the ACL knew would be enlivened by an awareness of about the materials.
Well,
I tend to think that she's right, that they do get a platform because of who they say they are, but as you know, we've discussed numerous occasions, the percentages of people that attend church on a weekly basis are now less than 8% or something like that.
Mm.
And you know, they are increasingly fighting over a diminishing pool of emphasis.
You would think their constituency is getting smaller.
Yes.
But I would put it to you, Scott, that their influence is not waning, and if anything, under this Liberal government, they've been quite successful. There's four things. I was going to mention also primary ethics, even though that was Fred Nile in New South Wales had the form changed. I'm sure the hand of the ACL is all over that as well. Like, you know, they're in this 20 paid staff members in Canberra walking the corridors continuously in the ear of conservative Catholic MPs, you know, whispering to them that they've got a problem if they don't have a plebiscite or if they don't attack safe schools. So sure, Corey Bernardi and George Christensen had their opinions already, but ACL would have been a very powerful voice, I reckon, in the corridors. Influencing, I mean, we'll never know. It's conjecture, but I think they're doing punching well above their weight.
Well, they certainly appear to be, but we'll see whether or not the you know, when the plebiscite comes up, then we'll see what their influence actually is. But I suspect that their influence will be well down below the 50% mark.
Let's hope so.
You know, well, I mean, I can't see that it's not going to be passed.
Anyway. Yeah. So I think you're right. But anyway, still a little bit more on the ACL. I've also got a copy of an email which was sent by Marion Shaw to religious instruction instructors.
I know, wasn't
it? Yeah. Basically talking about the religious instruction program on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. And she's claiming that through the RI program in local schools in your community, the message of the good news of Jesus Christ is being shared with over 80% of all primary school students. So they're claiming 80% of Sunshine Coast kids are getting safe school, are getting religious instruction lessons. Scott?
I'm not surprised. You know, there's been, because we've talked about changes to enrolment forms and that sort of stuff, and I don't know what the enrolment form looks like up here, but I would imagine it's probably similar to what's down south.
Well, you've got to tick a box. So you can nominate a religion and you can say no religion, or you could leave the whole thing blank. And Scott, what we have for the dear listener, and there'll be a link on the website, is a spreadsheet which shows the statistics for last year of enrolment forms. And statewide, when you look at these statistics, only, let me just get this right, only about... I really want to be careful I give you the right statistic here. Percentage of people who nominate a religion or is very low, like it's around the 25% mark. So either no religion nominated or leaving the thing blank is around the 75% mark. And so unless you've given written permission in some other format, the children are not allowed to attend religious instruction classes. So the Sunshine Coast schools, when you pick a selection of them, all follow the same sort of ratios that the rest of the state. So it doesn't make sense that this religious instruction can reach 80% of Sunshine Coast kids given the enrolment form data that we've got on the spreadsheet. So, Scott, I suspect kids on the Sunshine Coast are getting religious instruction who have not, you know, their parents haven't agreed to it.
Well, I would say that's probably right, yeah.
Mm. So, dear listener, if you follow our Facebook page, I put a little thing on yesterday, I think, to say that we were going to look at schools, and if you had your school in mind, you're wondering what the statistics were, you could let us know. Nobody has as yet. But I, for example, have quite often declared I really like the Gap State High School, which is where my kids went to. And can I tell you, Scott, that at that school, last year, 1,218 kids. That's quite a lot, isn't it?
Yep. It is.
And typical upper middle class suburb of Brisbane. Anglican, 47 kids. Catholic, 64. Just general Christian, 56. Baptist, 11. Nothing else reaches double figures. You got the odd Lutheran, the odd Orthodox, couple of Pentecostals, zero Seventh-day Adventist, one Sikh, 22 Uniting Church, 514 kids on their enrolment form, it was ticked no religion.
Yeah.
And 471 left that completely blank, didn't nominate a religion. So 514 plus 471 have absolutely no interest in religion, according to that form. Yet we've got a school chaplain who's in there a couple of days a week, and, you know, school's raising money for more funds for him. So it'll be interesting for you, dear listener. If you're in Queensland, you can check out your local state school and see what the religious figures were. And if your school is having religious instruction and you want to object to it, we'll trot out that statistic at a PNC meeting and say, why are we doing this when so few of our kids, their enrolment form shows any interest in religion at all? So find the statistic, go to a PNC meeting and object to religious instruction. That's my little rant there, Scott.
No, and you're exactly right. I mean, like, you know, you get going in there armed with the statistic and shut them down.
Hmm. So one other quote from this sort of local ACL
chapter.
I'm sorry
to cut you off. You're right. The worst that will happen is that they will have to maintain the religious instruction for those who are interested. And then the majority of the kids won't be in it. So
yeah, hopefully. Yep.
Yeah.
So anyway, on this little newsletter, it's one of the paragraphs reads, sort of bemoaning the fact that generally in the community, religious observance is down, but says, the greatest gift God has given us to reach these kids. The Queensland Education Act states that a principal must set aside up to an hour every week for the teaching of religious instruction. So, you know, they're quite right. That is the biggest gift they've got in terms of their proselytising. And I think on the Sunshine Coast, they must be ignoring the rules, I think.
So, well, to be getting 80% of the kids in there, they'd have to be ignoring the rules.
Hmm. Unless they're getting some sort of separate written permission, which seems unlikely. There's a Facebook page, Queensland Parents for Secular State Schools, and they quite often audit schools and check these sorts of things out. So anyway, have a look at their Facebook page as well. Just on that as well, there was a link to... I mean, we spoke last week about the sort of rubbish that gets taught in these lessons, and that ACL chapter had a link to some of the resources they use, which includes teaching creationism to these kids and teaching Noah and the boat story. And, you know, the problem with all this is they don't teach it as a story and say, you know, kids, some people believe this and some people don't, and you can make your own mind up. They just say, this is what happened. Isn't Jesus great? He's your best friend. There we go. There's an ACL rant to start me off, Scott.
No, but it is very true that, you know, you do have this ridiculous nonsense that comes up from time to time, and it's got to be dealt with.
Mm. Now, Scott,
yes.
Australia and Canada.
Yeah.
Similarities in the treatment of Indigenous people.
Yeah, I find that very interesting. You know, Aboriginal people make up 4% of the Canadian population, 25% of its prison population. In Australia, 3% of the population who identify as Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander make up 27% of those in prison.
It's an amazingly similar statistic.
It is, yeah. It is very, very similar.
Mm.
And
then it go on to say Aboriginal women make up a third of the female prison population in both countries. And a slight difference in incarceration rates of juveniles, where in Australia it's 59%, in Canada it's 40%. And in the child welfare system, again, the statistics were incredibly close, within a percentage of each other. So
50%, was it, concern for Aboriginal peoples, 50% of children were Aboriginal, the Australian rate is 51% were Aboriginal.
So, very similar stories between Canada and Australia in terms of what's happened in prisons with the Aboriginal population of each country. Amazingly similar statistics.
Now, did they go on to say why? They didn't really, did they? I suppose we've got similar histories.
Yeah. I don't think it did, other than the obvious sort of, the circumstances were so similar, and the colonisation was similar, and result is a similar outcome, I think is what they're saying. Although it does go on to say that, in this article, saying that the Canadian response to Aboriginal rights over there has been better than the local one in Australia. So a link to that on the website. I mentioned earlier, well, we've mentioned before, primary ethics classes in New South Wales and very successful program. Great, shows kids how to make decisions, not based on faith, but kind of putting yourself in someone else's shoes and using sort of just common sense reasons as to why something's good or bad. And it used to be that the primary ethics classes were on the enrolment form as an option for parents to tick. And the poisonous Fred Nile got that form changed, and Mike Baird, the cowardly, I don't know, what do we call him? Just,
well, he's certainly a cowardly little runt of a man, isn't he?
In order to get Fred Nile's vote, he agreed to this despicable act of removing the primary ethics from the enrolment form in New South Wales. And as a result, attendances have plummeted. And the right-wing Christian lobby has had a success in New South Wales by a simple thing of getting something, an option, taken off an enrolment form. It's such a simple thing.
The option still exists for parents, but because it's no longer in their face, they're not just saying, oh, yeah, I'll send my kids to primary ethics.
Yep, they don't know about it.
Yeah.
So if you're in New South Wales, check out with your school about the primary ethics program. It'll be a better option than the religious instruction one, but you won't see it on the enrolment form. So there's a win for the baddies, I'm afraid, Scott.
Well, it certainly is a win for the religious right, but it's not. Primary ethics is not dead, but it is hidden. So if you are in New South Wales and you do have children, go in there, find out primary ethics, and get your kids enrolled in it.
Have we discussed my objection to the primary ethics course anyway, Scott, on this podcast? I'll just repeat it anyway.
I don't think you have, but anyway, please go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the primary ethics classes are volunteer people come into the school and teach ethics. And there's a curriculum that they use and teaching materials, and it's all being worked out by well-qualified people. So the content's fine. I just object to the idea of volunteers coming into the school to teach anything, because I think that's a foot in the door for the religious people. So in Queensland, we don't have any primary ethics classes, and it's not a program that I would try and bring about, because you're really saying, yes, it's okay to have religious classes. Here's an alternative to religious classes. People can make their choice. The problem is the religious groups are so well organised, so well funded, they will provide 100 volunteers for every primary ethics volunteer, and they'll simply overwhelm the cause. So I think that in our state schools, we shouldn't have volunteers coming in teaching stuff. It should be part of the curriculum that teachers teach and keep outsiders out. So,
well, I wholeheartedly agree with you in that regard. I think it is ridiculous that you've got a situation where you have volunteers coming into classrooms anyway.
So, but anyway, for the moment, in New South Wales, if you're in that neck of the woods, try that out. Now, population, Scott. Like, we've got a migrant crisis around the world, and really, a huge part of the problem is overpopulation in marginal countries.
Yeah, and, exactly.
And a few statistics. So, in relation to Africa, by 2100, it's a bit more than, so 84 years away, which, Scott, as you get older, you realise isn't really that far away, is it?
No, that's true.
So, 80 years away, Africa's population, at current rates, could be 3 billion to 6.1 billion, up sharply from its 1.2 billion today. So it's a huge number of people in 80 years. It could go from 1.2 to 6 billion. And
I find that hard to believe because, I mean, Africa, although it shouldn't be, it's got problems feeding itself.
Yes.
And I just don't see them, if they get to a population of 6 billion, I just can't see the African continent feeding 6 billion people.
Yeah. Well, until women are empowered and offered yes. contraceptives, then
yes,
that's what's going to happen.
Mm. So it is incredible that you know, you've got this situation that women are basically baby factories for their next generation to, well, they breed a new generation to keep them when they're old.
Yeah. And, well, or they just don't have either A, they've got a religion telling them you can't have contraception, you're evil, or they're simply so poor that they don't have access to it. So one or the other. And we've got this flood of migrants into Europe from marginal countries. And really, if we're going to be spending money trying to sort this problem out, Scott, what could be better?
We've got to sort the problem out at the source.
Exactly.
You know, instead of spending money trying to close borders and all that sort of stuff, you know, we've got to sort the problem out at the source.
Hmm.
Now, that means that in Syria and that sort of stuff, we're going to have to, throw rocks at me for saying it, but we're probably going to have to put boots on the ground there in Syria and Iraq. But
where's my rock?
Yeah. No, we're probably going to have to put boots on the ground there, but we've got to do it in a very sensible way. And if we just go in the way we did in 2003, we'll end up with an even bigger disaster. But we're going to have to get involved. We're going to have to talk to the current government of Syria, and we're going to have to fix the problem once and for all. Then what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to go into Africa. Yes. Then we're going to have to go to Africa, and we're going to have to negotiate with them to try and restore their problems.
Gee,
are you there?
Well, I'm just picking myself up off the floor. Velvet Glove, where have you been in the last week? Where'd you go last week? Were you abducted?
No, I was not abducted. Right. I was not abducted, but no, it's,
hang
it's
on.
One of those things. Yeah, go on.
The problem with Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan, Scott, is... Have you been watching, by the way, a program on ABC about Australia's military involvement in Afghanistan?
No, I haven't actually. No,
fascinating. You really catch up with that one and watch it.
Okay.
Really fascinating. Going in with the best of intentions. Like on last night's show, it showed that the Australians were at a village and they were constructing, you know, hospitals and improving the roads and, you know, creating infrastructure. And the problem was that they were doing it on the, you know, the west side of the village, which was split by a creek or a river, and weren't doing it on the other side, basically because the tribal leaders on one side, you know, liked the idea and the other tribal leaders didn't. Well, after a while, the tribal leaders of the area that wasn't getting help started laying mines on the other side of town and blowing up the other villages. Like, not just blowing up Australians, but blowing up other villages. Like, it was just... And it wasn't a religious thing. It was a tribal thing. There are problems there, Scott, that we cannot fix. We can't go in and wave magic wands and knock heads together. It is impossible.
No, but what you've then got, if you don't try and resolve the problems, is you've then got a situation where you've got nothing being done to try and solve the problem back home. Therefore, you've got the only other option is to leave and to, you know, head to Europe.
Well, let's work on programs in in countries where we can offer contraceptives and they'll take them, food in parts of Africa where they need food, and education in countries where we'll be allowed to do that and we won't be stymied by religious groups. And if we can do that in a few countries and do nothing in other countries, at least we can be effective in some countries. But there's some countries, Scott, you could not... There is no answer. They have to do it themselves.
And there is no answer in a lot of countries. But like you are saying there, like if you can go into countries in Africa that would accept your help, and you can improve the situation there, then the population will then go from the basket cases. They will then leave there and go into the other countries that are more stable and secular. And that's where we've got to go to. At least we've got to get to a situation where the immigrants are not crossing the Mediterranean, they're staying on their side of the Mediterranean and going into the countries that are well governed and well looked after.
See, I don't know say somewhere like Myanmar, where there's the Rohingya sort of Muslim group there who are, you know, classified as the world's worst off refugees. I reckon our time and money is better spent with the Myanmar government saying, here's a bucket load of money that we're willing to spend on your country doing stuff, and we will build some roads and bridges and hospitals for you. But in return, we want to be able to set up some schools and set up some family planning options, etc., for your general population and the Rohingyas. And if they will agree to that, then that would be a great thing that we could do. But we are wasting our time in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria. Like, it's, we can't do anything. That has to be solved internally. It's mission impossible.
It does need to be solved internally, but you've also got a situation that maybe some boots on the ground.
And neighbouring countries should be doing it. Like, I picked Myanmar because it's kind of in our neck of the woods as well, so...
Yeah, and it is in our neck of the woods, and it's in our backyard. Yeah. It should be something that we solve.
And so that's what we should be doing, is sort of looking around our neighbourhood and trying to find countries that will accept help in return for certain other features that we think will help in the long run. And if they'll agree to that, great. And let's keep looking around until we can find countries that we can do that with. But the ones in the Middle East, the neighbouring countries, and internally, that's their backyard. They should be on that one. And
I agree with you on that point. And, you know, the Saudis, for example, you know, they've got, you know, we've talked about this before, their tents and that sort of stuff, but they have their tent cities for,
festival.
The festival, whatever it is. Anyway, they've got them all there that are empty most of the time.
Yep.
And yet they won't take even... You know, they've taken none of the Syrian refugees.
Yep.
you know, I find that incredible.
Yep.
That they're allowing their brethren Muslims to live fairly shocking lives rather than opening up these air-conditioned tents to these people.
One other statistic in another article will be linked with it is that, according to the UN, half of the population increase globally in the next 35 years is expected to come from Africa.
Yeah.
The global increase, half from Africa. So if we can do something about that, that would help to solve migrant issues into the future.
Well, we've got to do something now. We've got to try and help out Africa, so that they, once their population does get big and big and big, that they they're not leaving.
They're leaving now, but yes.
Well, they're leaving now, yeah. Mm. But if we can stop the problems, and if we can help solve the problems, then we'll end up having a situation that the African population will stay put rather than moving.
Mm. Scott, refugees. So Denmark is thinking about revising the UN Refugee Convention, saying that it's just not appropriate in this day and age. And I've read lots of times that if somebody came up with the resolution in relation to refugees today and it hadn't existed before, then no country would sign it, because it didn't anticipate the types of migration that we've got today. And I'm just tossing around this idea in my head, Scott. So refugee, according to the Geneva Convention, is a person who is outside their country of citizenship because they have a well-founded grounds for fear of persecution because of their race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group or political opinion, and is unable to obtain sanctuary from their home country, blah, blah, blah. So a refugee is a person who has a well-founded fear of persecution. And, you know, we talk about economic refugees as being, you know, not appropriate refugees.
Yeah.
But persecuted refugees are appropriate. Mm. And, well, here's what I'm getting to. Quite often the persecution is on religious grounds. So if you can't practice your particular form of mumbo jumbo, then you qualify as a refugee. However, if you're simply starving and there's nothing for you to eat, you don't qualify as a refugee. Like, if we're about reducing human suffering, I reckon we need to work on a different criteria for what a refugee is. And maybe,
that's a good point.
Maybe in certain circumstances, an economic refugee is actually, you know, far more, suffering
worthy.
Far more and far more worthy of assistance than a persecuted refugee. And with my bias, of course, you know, the fact that you can't openly practice your particular form of religion, but you can do it in secret, well, I'd rather be in that position than starving and unable to eat, like in the choices of human suffering that, you know, even if I've been brought up in that religion and I think, you know, it's so important to me, I'd still rather be denied some religious freedom than actual starvation. So I reckon we should be reconsidering the whole, you know, I don't know, when you sign up to a convention, how you get out of it or how you change it. But simple persecution because of membership of a religious group, well, I don't know, sometimes there's bigger issues, isn't there?
Well, there certainly seems to be bigger issues. And it's, although, you know, you've got that situation with the Bangladeshi bloggers, for example, who are, you know, they've been persecuted basically because they're non-religious.
Yes.
And, you know, they've got a situation that they've got food, they've got shelter, they've got everything else they need, except they're not safe.
Mm.
So from that point of view, then, you know, do you deny them their right? Do you deny them refugee status?
Well,
you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
Or do you allow them to go?
Yeah.
You know, it's...
Well...
It is.
It sounds harsh, but on one level, being unable to practice your brand of mumbo-jumbo is not as bad as a situation where you're being forced to practice a mumbo-jumbo that you really wished you didn't have to. So, which is what the atheists are forced to do, to pretend to be religious. It's a degree thing, I admit, but you know, in both cases I'd say I'd still rather be that person than the person who's absolutely dying of starvation, and they'd have a greater claim for assistance but technically not persecuted.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So anyway, that's refugees. Came across an article from John Menadou. We've mentioned him before with his blog, and a bit of an article about wasting food in France is now illegal, and supermarkets must either compost or donate unsold or nearly expired goods to charity, and the law prohibits stores from pouring bleach over food items to prevent homeless people from foraging, etc., etc. So, good on you, French government, prevent wastage. And it just made me think, Scott, of a story. We have relatives who are teaching English in China, and they go to this all-you-can-eat buffet-type place, and what they've done in this restaurant is really interesting. They, when you've finished your meal, if you've left food on your plate that has to be thrown away, you have to pay a surcharge extra on top of the bill.
Yeah.
So they don't care how much you eat. Like, go back to the, you know, buffet as many times as you like. But they had so many cases of people, you know, just totally loading up their plates and then just being unable to eat it. And a huge plate, you know, their fifth one, just sitting there that has to be thrown out. But, if your plate is not empty when you're ready to finish, leave, then you pay a surcharge. I reckon that's a great idea.
Well, it is a great idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Ever heard of that before?
I have heard of it before.
Really?
And that's been there's a Korean place not far from me.
Right.
That they have a sign up saying that if you've got food left over, they charge you for it.
Is that right? Yeah. Ah, very good.
Yeah.
Very good. Scott, negative gearing. It's in the news.
Yes, it is in the news. And I'm really surprised at the... because two, 3 weeks ago, you brought up an analysis of what people think.
Yes.
And there was only, 40 or 50% of the population were in favour of doing something with it, which I found really surprising.
Mm.
And then on top of that, to then have this backbench rebellion where you've got the rebels from the coalition saying, no, you can't touch it. It's really bizarre to me that neither side is actually, well, that you've got the government being held to ransom, you know. It's phenomenal.
Right. I thought the statistic was kind of a surprising number of people were happy to do something about negative gearing. You don't think?
I don't recall it, but I don't recall it exactly, thought it was.
I've got it here, The Wonders of Google, and I had the essential report on my screen, Scott, because it is quiz time soon. But well, here it was. Do you approve or disapprove of the Labor Party policy to change negative gearing? so that for future purchases, investors can only claim tax deductions for investments in newly built homes. So approving the Labor Party policy, 38%. Disapproving, 28%. And a lot of don't knows. So that was okay. Still a majority.
Yeah, that was still a majority, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know, I reckon there's a mood for negative gearing. But anyway, Scott, the really obvious part, well, there's two parts of negative gearing, is the way it's set up is your expenses in the short term are in excess of your income, so you get to write down your taxable income. But the other thing is that when you sell the property, instead of paying tax on the full capital gain, you only pay tax on half the capital gain.
Yeah.
And that's just ridiculous, isn't it? Is there any good reason for that?
Well, the reason why it went like that is because prior to that you had a situation where you used inflation numbers and that sort of stuff to drive up the cost base.
Yes.
So if you bought a property for $100,000,
yep,
and then you inflated it, and then you only paid tax on the capital gain, the net capital gain, which was
right
the what you actually sold the property for,
yes,
less the index cost base. The index cost base was the $100,000 that was then inflated.
Yes. Yep.
So that's the case. So that's what they did. That's what used to happen.
Yep.
Then they decided that the simplest thing to do was say, well, if you held the asset for longer than 12 months, then you get a 50% discount on what the profit is.
Right.
So if you owned a $100,000 property and sold it for $150,000 after 6 months, you paid tax on the full $50,000.
Yep.
If you then made $50,000 on the same property but you held it for 12 months, then you paid tax on $25,000.
Yeah, yep.
Okay, so that's why they did that.
Right.
Yep,
but so they scrapped the indexation option. So
yes.
Why? Is it just...
Oh, I don't
did it, did
know.
It roughly I mean, I work... It was... Would it roughly... If you held an investment property for like 12 years, was it kind of... It would roughly work out to... You bought it for 100... Indexed up to 150 and sold it for 200, so it was kind of the same figure?
It probably was something like that.
Right.
That they came up with 50%.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why the hell they did it. I mean, I used to calculate the things, and it wasn't that bad.
Mm.
You know, just doing the cost base, it was easy.
Yeah. So that's, anyway, the two things that need to be talked about in the negative gearing policy options is the actual, you know, year-by-year deductions, whether you can claim them, and then the second part is this 50%.
Well, I mean, yeah, and he's hit the nail right on the head in his final line. He said, remove the 50% capital gains tax discount, negative gearing losses lose some of its shine.
Mm.
You know, it's really, it's... It's very good.
I heard Scott Morrison talking about negative gearing, and he was basically saying, you know, the proposed changes are not going to generate, you know, that much extra revenue for the government. And I just wanted to yell at him and say, you know, the main part about this is that negative gearing is driving up prices for houses. That's making it harder for young people to buy a house. So I'm not so much concerned about... you know, collecting more tax. It's just trying to get these investors out of the market because they're artificially inflating the price so that young people can just afford to buy a house. Like, that's the main sort of gripe I've got with negative gearing is driving up house prices.
Look, I agree with you. I mean, it's taken me a long time to come to that conclusion, but I think it is right that you've got to... You know, I don't think you should go backwards on it. I think you should, I mean, you know, Labor's policy is probably right in that if you've got an investment property now, you get to keep the tax deductions and all that sort of stuff, but then any new investments that you then take out in the future have got to be new builds.
Mm.
But, you know, that's... to my way of thinking, probably the most sensible way to do it.
Yeah. I reckon the time's getting right for people to like that one, and it'll be an interesting one, a bit of squeeze on the government. Now, Scott, the quiz. So this is from Essential Report, and two-party preferred, Scott, according to this statistic. What do you reckon the split is between the government and Labor on the according to their polls here at Essential Report?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's going to be close to 50-50, is it?
Very good, Scott. You're a very improved player on the Essential Report. 50-50, that's right. According to the Essential Report, if you had an election today, 50-50. So, yeah, the shine's gone off Malcolm Turnbull, hasn't it? Like, he's just...
It has gone off very quickly, yes.
He's just performing pretty much like the sort of decisions he's making you'd expect from Tony Abbott.
Well, I don't know if you go quite that bad, but they are, you know, they're not good decisions. And he hasn't really done an awful lot.
No.
I think that's probably the main problem is that, you know, everyone was expecting him that he would be all things to all men, but he's turned out not to be.
Mm. Another question on Senate reform. So,
yes.
Dear listener, we have this. We've had a system whereby if you just nominate your candidate with a simple one, then preferences would flow according to what the candidate's party had arranged in the back room with other parties. And the result was the preference whisperer and Ricky Muir getting into Parliament. And so government's proposing to change that system, Scott. How many do you reckon are approve changing that, and how many disapprove?
I'd say it's probably 40 approve, 40 disapprove, and 20% don't know.
53 approve and 16% disapprove, and then the 30% don't know. So that's a pretty strong indication that people want that changed. I do. And I know the Secular Party has been putting all sorts of submissions in about this issue. And honestly, Scott, I haven't really followed it because last election we didn't do any deals. So we just left it up to our voters. Is that right?
Well, we had to nominate preferences.
There, you have to.
But we didn't actually get. Yeah, you do have to nominate a preference.
Okay.
So we did go in and we did do preferences, but we didn't do it as a deal.
Right.
It wasn't.
It wasn't done in return for something.
No.
Right.
No, there wasn't anything like that. It was. It was based on. Those parties that were more secular.
Right.
Got our preferences.
Yep. So that was that issue. And, well, Scott, they're talking about double dissolution. What do you reckon? Is that likely to happen, do you think?
Well, up until a week ago, I would have said no, but now I'm not so sure. It certainly looks like, you know, that they said that the Electoral Commission said they needed 3 months to implement this new system. So, you know, it appears that that'll be rammed through Parliament fairly soon, and then after that they got 3 months, and then bang, well, we could be in a poll.
Yeah. There's another one here. It's a bit difficult for me to question you on it because it's so many options, but basically they ask people which are the three most important issues in deciding how you will vote at a federal election. And starting at the top with the most important issue, which was ensuring the quality of Australia's health system. That was number one.
Really?
Number two was management of the economy. Number three was Australian jobs and protection of local industries. Number four was ensuring a fair taxation system. Five was housing affordability. And six was ensuring a quality education for all children. Seven was security and the war on terror. So they were the main ones. Just interesting that the health system came out as the number one priority for people.
Yeah, this morning I listened to the health minister, and she said that because you know they were talking about the the round of increases that the private health insurance companies have asked to actually give, you know, grant us all. And she said that she felt that the negotiation was wrong, in that they weren't negotiating properly with their suppliers, because a pacemaker cost a private health insurer $43,000, but it cost the state $17,000.
Right. Yeah.
Now, that's incredible. If that's the case, then we've really got to ask ourselves the question whether or not we're barking up the wrong tree, and should we have a entirely national health system, you know, that we, instead of having us all going off and contributing to private health insurers, should we have, you know, dare I say it, double the Medicare rate, and just have gold-plated bloody health system?
That could work. Well, anyway.
Well, it would work.
It's, you know, it's obviously the number one issue for people with their voting intention at the next federal election. So,
well, you know, I mean, it is true. I mean, like, you look at how much you actually pay on a monthly basis to private health insurance, and, you know, me and the better half had this conversation tonight. We're wondering if we should ditch ours.
Right.
You know, it's, yeah. Anyway.
Yep. And in the top five, also interesting, was housing affordability made it to number five, which proves the point that negative gearing option is an important one. So, and then the rest of the questions there weren't particularly interesting. So anyway, that was a brief run of the quiz. Scott, just quickly, Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster.
In New Zealand.
Yeah. They've obviously got very generous and relaxed laws in New Zealand to allow any group to provide marriage celebrants. So they don't get their knickers in a knot in New Zealand over marriage celebrants. And I like the article because there was just a number of bad puns. So Kiwi couples wanting to tie the noki rejoice. New Zealand has its first Pastafarian marriage celebrant. And Department of Internal Affairs has given its seal of approval to the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster's first marriage celebrant, or as they like to call a celebrant, a ministeroni. They had a wedding. They had a wedding planned and it fell through because the couple decided against tying the knot. And but there won't be long, and there'll be one in New Zealand.
Well, there will be, and it is only a matter of time before someone actually gets them to do it.
Yeah.
So
a minister.
But I liked the article too, because it was full of puns, like you said.
A ministeroni. Yes. Cardinal Pell, do you got anything to say about our friend Cardinal Pell at all? He's,
I mean, how ridiculous was he when he was in there? He was in there and he was asked questions, and he says, "Oh well, I didn't pay much attention to that because it didn't really interest me."
Terrible line.
I mean, for God's sake! I mean, you know, even if that's what you thought, you wouldn't say it, would you?
Yes. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was probably the thing that really came to mind for me anyway, was how ridiculous he was to actually say that.
It was a bad moment for him. And, you know, maybe it's backfired a little bit on him doing the interviews in Rome, because apparently a lot of press over there are, you know, following it. And it's probably got more international sort of exposure than if he'd have come back to Australia. And
well, I think so, yeah.
So absolutely. I think it might have backfired on him doing it over there. And if he'd have come here, it would have stayed out of the news a little bit more internationally anyway. So we'll see what happens with Cardinal Pell. And just briefly, I had an article that related to the caste system in Delhi in India, and there was a particular caste who previously were doing quite well, and they were traditionally a farming community caste, but with the downturn in farming and to a more technological sort of age, they're starting to be not as well thought of, and they're missing out on jobs, and so they're demanding to be added to the list of castes that are eligible for reserved government jobs in India. And I just find the whole notion of a caste where you are born into a group and you're stuck in that caste and you can... It's a terrible notion of just... It's just racism, isn't it, Scott? And
it's really appalling that how many years has it been since they got independence? What, 1950, shall we say? So they've had 65 years of independence. And they're still stuck in this ridiculous situation that really should have been killed off centuries ago.
Yeah, it's just very racist. And look, we've got a young family friend, and she is from an Indian family. And, you know, you just hear stories that, like, her parents would be quite appalled if she married a non-Indian, you know, and it's...
Yeah.
These are very racist ideas, which you could never say as a white person. Like, I hope you don't, marry an Indian. Like, you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, so a bit of an article about the caste system. I don't know a lot about it at the moment, but it just struck me as being just a very racist notion that seems to be considered acceptable when really it shouldn't be.
Well, it really shouldn't be. No, it's phenomenal that they're still actually having to go through it.
Oh, gee, I don't know, Scott. There's a lot of countries on the list that I will just never go to. And Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, they're right at the top of the list. I will never go.
Yeah. No, I don't blame
Particularly if they ever found out I was producing this podcast. That would...
Yeah.
That would... If they had a sniff of what we're doing here, Scott, and we were walking through the transit lounge in one of those countries, we would be in diabolical trouble.
Yes, that's very true.
Mm. There we go. Mm. All right, folks. Well, let's putting episode 34 to bed. Thank you, Scott. Good to have you back. And
no worries. It's good to be back.
We shall be scurrying. Well, we'll be checking out all the news articles over the next week, looking for secular-related stuff in Australia and around the world. And we'll have... Oh, we can talk about Super Tuesday when we come back as well and see what's happened in America. And it's looks like Donald Trump's going to make it, doesn't it, Scott? Like, he's going to get the nomination.
Well, it does look like Donald Trump's going to make it for the Republican side. The Democrats looks like it'll be Hillary Clinton. Mm. But, you know, Bernie Sanders is not giving up yet. So, you know, we'll see. Mm.
All right, Scott. Very good. We will talk to you next week. Bye for now, everyone.
No worries. Well, thanks very much. Bye now.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf, on their phone, and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't
listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation, so you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners, and that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.